Hey folks, you're listening to Know the Land, broadcasting from the treaty territories of the Mississauga of the Credit on 93.3 FM at the University of Guelph. Maybe you're listening to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever else you listen to your podcasts. It's a show about our connections with the land base, how we interact with the land, how we learn about the land, how we defend the land. My name is Byron, and today I get to talk to Troy McMullen, author of Lichens, the Macro Lichens of Ontario and the Great Lakes Region of the United States, which is out now on Firefly Books. Troy, can you introduce yourself?
Hi, yeah, thanks for having me on. I'm Dr. Troy McMullen from the Canadian Museum of Nature. And here I'm a research scientist in lichenology. I specialize in lichens across Canada.
I'm grateful you said doctor. You worked hard for that, and I'm sorry for skipping that part, but
oh, no problem.
A friend of mine just did their thesis defense this morning, so I want to make sure I get everybody right when they've put in the work. When you were just beginning to study lichens, I this question keeps coming up for me. When you were first beginning to study lichens, did you find the field intimidating?
No, the when I started, I found the field empty. Is how it started. My path was, I was a high school teacher teaching outdoor education and biology, and I wanted to get a master's, and I thought I would just do it in something that resonated with me. So I traveled across the country and checked in at a number of universities and talked to different professors and what they were studying. And there was an old growth forest project in Nova Scotia that was trying to determine, they needed someone to join their team to determine how much old growth we need to protect the unique species that only live in old growth. And that really resonated with me, growing up in Ontario and being a big part of the fight to save some of the old growth in Ontario. This is something that resonated with me. So then I looked into, well, okay, what species are unique to old growth? And lichens kept coming up, and I thought, okay, how hard can these be? And I'm still trying to figure them out. But from there, that's how I kind of got into them. And there wasn't really many people around that I could say do a graduate degree with that were studying lichens. There was very few lichenologists, but there was not none. And so I did spend a large portion of my master's sort of wandering around to different labs all over North America to learn this craft, this trade. And and when I was done, there was my phone never really hasn't really stopped ringing since to just help out with bio blitzes or, just surveys of different sorts, because there aren't many folks out there with lichenological skills that can contribute to these things. And they're an important part of every terrestrial ecosystem.
I feel like if I remember correctly, you've published hundreds of papers, or lots of papers, I shouldn't say hundreds, lots of papers. You've published a couple of books. I have one book in front of me, Woodlot Biodiversity, that you contributed a chapter with Dr. Stephen Newmaster here at the University of Guelph.
That's right.
And I have Common Lichens of Northeastern North America, which you co-wrote with Francis Anderson.
Right.
You have written the books, maybe after Brodo, it seems like comes Troy McMullen for the books on lichens in Canada, and now this new one for the macro lichens of Ontario. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, this new book, the macro lichens of Ontario and the Great Lakes region of the United States, which is out on Firefly Books, what is different in that one than the common lichens of Northeastern North America?
Well, to put some background to it all, Brodo was my predecessor here at the Museum of Nature. And he wrote the big Lichens of North America book. It's a 10-pound book that covers all the regions of North America. It covers the tropical regions, the Arctic regions, the deserts, the rainforests, the temperate, the boreal. And so all of these different ecosystems are in this book, and you have to kind of wade through those keys. You're comparing species that may not be in the same ecosystems, and so there's a lot of information. And that one still covers the common ones, that even in that big giant book, it's not covering the complete suite. And the common lichens of North America, or northeastern North America, that I wrote also only covers the common things. And with lichenology, borrowing this phrase, is commonality is rare and rarity is common. So there's a small number of species that make up the bulk of what we see. And those are the ones that are getting into the book, into those books. But the majority of them are majority of lichens are rare or uncommon. And those are the ones that tend to not make it into the field guides because you don't see them as often. So what I wanted to do is produce a comprehensive guide that included every species that you'll see. So this new book covers every macro lichen in Ontario. If it's here, it'll be in that book. And so this is the first of its kind like that for Canada, for there to be a book with color photos and keys that is comprehensive for any region. I also published a book about a year ago that's for young naturalists. It's sort of an introductory book on lichens.
I saw that, and I teach young people, and I thought I'm gonna get this from the library and bring it to the school and Great. Share it with them, and then go on a little bit of a lichen hunt with them and see what we can find. At least find some sunbursts and stuff like that, because I think we have those nearby. So,
yeah, I like to refer to lichens as the corals of the forests or the terrestrial world as well, because they've got all the colors like a coral reef. They've got all the, you know, wildly different shapes like a coral reef, and there are multiple organisms working together like a coral reef, and they're eating what washes by like a coral reef. You know, there's lots of neat parallels you can draw.
That's cool. Are there any like non-native invasive, quote unquote invasive lichens causing problems?
And not, well, that's the problem with our lack of information, is that we don't have very good baselines, you know, in Canada. But there is one that people have been studying in Southern Ontario, which has typically been, they call it the maritime sunburst lichen. It's one of the bright orange ones. And it's typically only like really close to the coasts on both sides of North America. And it's a nitrophile, so it likes to grow where the birds are, like the seabirds are roosting. So there's a lot of, like, if you go out and see a big orange covered rock in the coastal areas, that's maritime sunburst lichen usually. And it started showing up in Southern Ontario, and you know, some lichenologists like Brodo, like my predecessor, and others around Ontario had started noticing, well, this thing's starting to show up more and more and more, and started looking into it. And we're starting to see that, you know, in Ottawa, someone had been studying it really closely here before I got here, and almost every record in Ottawa is on a nursery tree. Nursery trees coming from the coast. Wow. And it's starting, so it's now in the Arboretum. When I was there, there was two or three individuals in the Arboretum. And it's just starting to pop up. So this would be a, you know, an example of exotic, I would say. We don't know for a fact that it's invasive. I like to think of invasive as actually pushing other species out and causing harm. Yeah. It may not be causing any harm, but it's definitely being established here, and it's doing well here. So why is it doing well here? You know, there's some, you know, the nitrification, artificial nitrification. So there's like artificial deposition of nitrogen, human caused, in this region. And it could be from that, like, you know, if it likes the nitrogen that it's getting on the coast, well, if it gets enough of it in Southern Ontario, that might be why they're here, or might be why they're doing well here.
Is Trentopolia the photobiont of that?
It's not. It's Trabuxia.
Okay.
But yeah, it's good that you know these things. I mean, yeah, that's the big divide in green algae. Is the Trabuxia versus Trentopolia.
I'm just
the two major groupings.
I'm just learning about it because I see a lot of like orange tint to like hemlock trees and poplars coming up. Mm-hmm. And in the research side of the Arboretum, I've seen it a lot there on the hemlocks. And then on in Ontario Nature Conservancy area, I've seen it on a big spruce, I think it is. And so I've just been wondering about Trentopolia and its expansion, because I've heard it wasn't always as far north, or at least as broadly spread as it is now. But can you describe some of those basic differences between the micro and the macro lichens?
Sure. The macro lichens grow on the surface. The micro lichens grow into the surface. So lichens are just predominantly fungi. And so there are these little hyphae that grow. They're extremely small. They're so small they can grow into the space in between the minerals of the rock in a dense rock like quartz or granite, and become one with the rock. And when those ones, they cannot be peeled off or anything. You have to take a chip of the rock if you want to actually study them. So those ones are considered the micro ones. So it's not necessarily that they're smaller. There's some really small macro lichens, but the defining feature is that they grow on the surface. And you can like peel them off, or cut them off the knife, but the micro lichens become one with their substrate.
I really like that answer. And I think it gets a little bit deeper than some of the answers I've heard otherwise. It brings up another question that I have. Like, when I think about the lichens, I think about the structure of the lichens, the fungi, and then it was commonly told to me earlier on that the other part of the lichen was the photobiont, or the algae that was making up like this cohabiting with the fungi to photosynthesize and produce sugars for the fungi. But then I've been reading lately that there's more than the two organisms. So I've heard two, and I've also heard up to four organisms. How many different organisms make up a lichen, and or does it depend on the species?
It does depend on the species. So in terms of the big major components. So a fungi makes up the bulk of the lichen. And then there's a photosynthesizing partner involved, sometimes two photosynthesizing partners. Sometimes it's an alga and a cyanobacterium. But then there's also a microbiome. And that microbiome can include other fungi. It can include bacteria. And all of that comes together to make this package, this ecosystem that we call a lichen. And you could almost compare the microbiome to a human microbiome or any animal, right? Like, we have bacteria that we need. We have fungi that we need to function, right? And so in if you're looking at it on that fine of a scale, you're talking about it being the same. We're symbiotic in those ways. So lichens largely just get lumped in as I think the term symbiosis came from lichens, with these two organisms or three working together. But there's more to it than that. And you may have heard that lately. There's been a lot of talk in the media about redefining lichens. And because there's these other microorganisms involved in the whole structure, and certainly they're a necessary part of it. So just saying it's a symbiosis between these two things isn't quite accurate. And it's one of the reasons that lichens are ubiquitous. They're everywhere. They're on the trees in your front yard, on your sidewalks. Like, they're just, there's hundreds of them growing right in your back, well, in the forest near you. And, but scientists have always had a very difficult time taking pure cultures of these things, like taking just the one fungus and the one algae and putting them together. I'm like, why aren't you making a lichen? Because there's more to it that's going on, right? So it's a complicated story. They're little ecosystems. They're fungi living a particular lifestyle. Go ahead.
I just like to think of them as little ecosystems, right? Like, yeah, all these different component parts coming together and then functioning in different ways. I've heard them working together as symbionts, and then I've also proposed the idea is, does the fungi act like a cage holding everything together, farming out the alga? I don't know that stuff. You'd know that stuff better than I would, but I just think
those are all great. I agree. Like, there's lots of perspectives, whether it's a symbiosis or a parasitism or what, but that's kind of humanizing it a bit. They function how they function, and we can classify it any way we want, but it's a life form. It's a relationship, that, and however you want to define it, it doesn't care.
So these lichens are creating these small ecosystems, these small ecologies. And I was wondering, like, what can lichens teach us about the broader ecologies that they're participants of? Because you once said in an article I found, they're like the canary in the coal mine. What do you mean by that?
Well, one interesting thing about them is, you know, fungi, for the most part, a large part, lives in things. It lives in dead wood. It lives in soil. And then what we see sticking up as a mushroom is just the reproductive parts, you know, but it's in there. It's getting its energy and nutrients from breaking down the things that it's living within. So lichens have changed that narrative. They've come out. The fungi has come out of what they're living in, and they're kind of this self-sustaining little package now, and they can just live on things. And I also like to refer to them as the pioneers of ecological succession, because if a volcano erupts, they can go and live on that bare rock, and they don't need anything else because they're getting their nutrients and their minerals from the atmosphere, from the moisture in the atmosphere, precipitation, from water that washes over them. So in effect, they're just little sponges. So just absorbing whatever's passing by, a lot like coral does. And that means that they're really, if there's pollutants in the air, there's acid rain, they're gonna just suck it right in. And unlike vascular plants that have soil to buffer pollutants and that sort of thing before it gets taken in by the plant, these ones take it in directly. And it's instant, and so they're much more sensitive than other organisms, hence the canaries in the coal mine, right? If things start to change, they're more likely to respond before other organisms.
Have you noticed in your research changing habitats or habits of lichens in regards to climate change?
Yes, for sure. I mean, lichens fill a lot of ecological niches. Like, they fill all kinds of different, in every ecosystem. Like, you know, I was saying there's some species that like old growth, and there's some species that like middle-aged forests and young forests, and there's some that like to be exposed, and some that like to be shaded, and some that likes to be like it in the wet, and some that like it in the dry. So they've just, there's so many of them, and they've filled all these different ecological niches. So if an environment changes, for example, the tree line's marching north into the Arctic, as it marches north, the boreal lichens are marching up with it, and the Arctic lichens are disappearing from in that transition zone. So you see it all the time. I mean, you can walk through the forest and you just see a downed tree. And if it's an older forest, you're going to see a big gap and light coming in, and you're going to see a completely different suite of lichens growing in the gap where that light is coming in than you will in the darker parts of the forest. So yes, I see change on a perpetual basis, but so you can use lichens to really understand the ecological world. You can I rarely have to look up, at least in Ontario and places that I'm familiar with, to see what tree type it is, because the lichens on the trunk tell me what kind of tree it is. And
yes,
so there's lichens that like certain types of trees. There's lichens that like trees at certain stages of development. There's lichens that will tell you where the nutrients are in an ecosystem, where the water is flowing through an ecosystem. So the more you know about lichens, the more you can kind of read an ecosystem based on who is there. And so when things are changing, like sometimes I'll walk into an old growth forest that I think this should have all kinds of old growth forest species, but it doesn't. So right away, I'm like, why? Why are they not here? You know, was this harvested? Is it truly old growth? Is it near a point source pollution output, like a factory or even close to a road? Is it so small that it doesn't have a buffer and the wind is blowing right through? And one of the characteristics of old growth is that it holds on to a high moisture, but it's not happening in this stand because it's too small. blah, blah, blah. Like, so right away, I just started thinking about these things. So you start to just be able to read and see the ecological worlds in a different way.
I'm really excited about that. You write in the preface of the book that lichens also illustrate nutrient inputs, like you named, such as animal dens or roosts. And for me, I study wildlife tracking, and like I'm really interested in looking at the dynamics in the forested landscape or anywhere, and seeing how plants, fungi, animal all work together. And to see the signs of the animals moving through the landscape, through all the other life forms that are there. And so I was wondering if you could, I know you touched on it in a broad view, but and maybe this is my own peculiarity, but I was wondering if you could tell me more about your own experience of noticing lichens in relationship to other animals, or to animals, pardon me.
Well, definitely. I mean, in the Arctic, I go up to the Arctic every year. The museum here has a real focus on the Arctic, and then so Nunavut has become a very large research site for me. So I go to new areas every year, and when I do, I seek out. Well, first, I mean, one thing I'll do is just notice like where raptors are nesting or any birds are nesting on a cliff. Right, all the nutrients that they're inputting into that system, the lichen community beneath those nests, if there's been a colony there for many years, will be different. Like they'll be nitrogen-loving species, and they can really, well, they're right there. That shapes the lichens, but that's not necessarily that would be an indication that there are birds above. And actually, I did that even this summer. There was a raptor's nest, and we couldn't see it. And we were looking, and based on the lichens, we were able to say, oh, okay, there it's there. We couldn't see the nest until we saw the lichens below that were different. So it's the same idea with like bird roosts, like just where they're hanging out. There's usually a bright orange lichen that is a nitrogen-loving species, and it will cover rocks where there's like regular, in historical roosts. In the Arctic, and then even outside of animal dens, wolf dens, and you'll see lots of everything. It'll be greener. Like you can fly in a helicopter over the many areas of the Arctic, particularly in the high Arctic where it's quite dry. You can spot a wolf den based on the green, the lush green area outside of it, and you go there, and the lichens will be reflective of that as well.
That's beautiful. And like to think of those connections and those relationships inspires me and gets me excited to like really dig into those lichens, because it's an organism of connections and relationship, like you've named. But
Yeah.
I just want to also highlight when you're talking about that there, it reminded me of one of my favorite photos in the book, and it's near the beginning of the book, and it was an aerial view of Hudson Bay Lowlands in Northern Ontario.
Yeah.
And it's this aerial view, but it looks like a lichen in and of itself. And it's green, and there's probably, was it black spruce probably, and then all over the ground there, it's like almost a substrate of white, and all the white areas are mats of cladonia.
That's right.
And it's incredible to look at that. And I remember going in some parks where you just walk, and everywhere you step, you're stepping on cladonia. It's just like there's no option but to crush the cladonia, and you feel so bad. But it's amazing how much there is. Whereas when I'm here in Guelph, and there's still so much, but it's definitely not the same as when I'm up north and experiencing, the broad lichen landscapes up there.
Exactly. So it's easy to see how that is a primary food source for woodland caribou in the winter months. Like it's so extensive and there's so much of it, and they have a strong relationship with the lichens, right? Like they that's how they get through the winters.
I would love to see a lichen-based scat, just like the scat where it's just predominantly lichen that they're eating. And does it shape it in full ways, or does Do new lichens just grow on those lichen scats or something like that? I don't know. I think it'd just be really neat to start looking at that
It
stuff. Someone's master's project, I'm sure.
would, yeah.
Yeah. Well, if we talk about lichens in this idea of canaries in the coal mine, there's also that book that came out, Jessica Allen and James Lendemer, I think his name is, on
That's
urban lichens. And so how do they also exist in these urban situations? Like in that book, there's photographs of lichens from subway stations. There's photographs of lichens on sidewalks. How are they living there as well?
right. So lichens have a gradient of tolerance to different emissions and things in the atmosphere. And so I work with Parks Canada, and we've set up air quality monitoring plots in the parks. And when we do that, we choose the lichens that are really intolerant to any pollutants of any sort. And then we put up grids, and we go back and look at them and see how they've changed. And if there's new pollutants introduced, they will be the first to tell us. But on the other end of the spectrum, there are what we call tolerant species that actually seem to like urban environments that, aren't all that common in the natural landscape, but they are really common in the city. So there's this whole gradient. Different lichens will be sensitive to different chemicals in the environment and different conditions. But there's suites that are in the urban environment that are very similar. Anywhere you go, like in the northeastern North America, they'll probably be different in Western North America. And In Guelph, I did my PhD at Guelph, and we wrote the woodlot book. When I first went in there, I'm like, wow, these the same species keep showing up, and I call them the Big Six. And there's like these big six species that are just everywhere I go around there, and they're the dominant species. And now that I know more, those are the dominant species in most of the cities in northeastern North America, and it's because they're tolerant to, most pollutants. And so there's a whole gamut. There's a few books written just on air quality and the different lichens and which ones will indicate what. If things get too polluted, then they're not going to there's going to be no lichens. But if there's just small amounts, and our air quality is relatively good comparatively to the past. So actually, the Arboretum in the back of the University of Guelph was my first study site. And there I found about 110 species of lichens. And a lot of them, though, did not look particularly healthy. And so there's either two reasons. There's either the pollutants in the air are still having an effect on them, or, which is my hypothesis, is that the air quality has improved since the 80s. And I think they're just getting started. They're just colonizing, and because the air quality has improved.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Is there a correlation between more like foliose and fruticose lichens in less polluted habitats and more like crustose lichens in more polluted habitats?
Yep, that's a good, that fits well. Sort of the general size of lichens does tend to correspond with cleaner air. So if you're seeing like these big long ones or big leafy ones, they tend to be, that's a fair assessment for sure. There are ones that are like microlichens that will grow only in cleaner environments, and there are some exceptions. Like Parmelia salcata is a relatively large macro lichen, and it really likes the cities.
And then you probably wouldn't find that you don't see a lot of rock tripe in the cities. But I mean, you also there, I imagine, I'm thinking of some other ones. I can't even remember their names, but they, what is it? Like lungwort? No.
Lungwort, yeah,
Lungwort, is that one?
nice one, yeah.
Yeah. I don't think I've
Absolutely.
ever seen that in a city.
No, well, interestingly, so one of my research projects is reviewing work done by John McCown. He was the first like federal botanist working, for the Canadian government. He essentially had my position, but in the 1800s, in the late 1800s. And he was the first one collecting specimens and putting them into the collection here. So that's our baseline. What he collected then is all we have access to. We don't know to talk about, at least in Canada, about how things have changed and that sort of thing. And Guelph is a perfect example. In Guelph, he collected lungwort there,
cool.
and some other ones that are like known to be intolerant species. And now we don't see them. That the nearest place you would see that species would be Bruce Peninsula from Guelph. So I call it McCown's receding lichen line, and I'm trying to look up rare or more sensitive species that he collected in areas that they're no longer present, and where do they occur now, and see and show how things have been changing.
That's pretty cool. My friend Tasha wrote, I mentioned that I'm interviewing you, and she wrote that why is the genus Cladonia so diverse? There seems to be so much morphology, it's so different. The morphology is so different in various species in the genus.
Yeah, that's a great question. And the bigger answer is just because things happen, you know. But it's a really interesting genus in that it's so plastic. Like each individual can have multiple faces, you know. Some of them can have up to like three or four different forms that aren't even really related. So now you're talking about this hyper diverse genus with these very plastic species, and so it's one of the more difficult genera to learn, and yet it's usually the dominant or genus in many environments. It's so much so that people have moved it around in the past, as in when Brodo wrote his big Lichens of North America book, at that time all the reindeer lichens had been moved into Cladina because they were so unique and different, but molecular work suggested that they shouldn't be, and then they were moved back, but they were written as Cladina in Brodo's book, and so people still use that as a category for them. But ultimately they all have this one character that's consistent, and that's that they're hollow when they grow, and they have a stereome, which is like cartilage almost inside, kind of like your nose, which helps keep them upright. And so they have the stereome and the hollowness, and that's a unique character among lichens. So that's what defines that genus. But yeah, it is extremely rich. There's over 90 species in Ontario. And for macro lichens, there's no bigger genus. There's none that are even close.
I think it was the first that I ever noticed. I think probably some people might be familiar with British soldiers. And I remember seeing them on a walk at the Arboretum and being like, what's this? And I'm thinking it's a mushroom of some kind, right? But yeah, that's pretty cool. And I one thing you just mentioned, and that the stereome, your book is great because it contains so many big photos, and there's a great illustrated glossary at the back, not photos but drawings, and I really appreciate having that. I need those in books on lichens and many other kinds of books, so I really appreciate that. And if folks, there's like a key to the 113 macro lichen genera of Ontario near the beginning, so you can follow along. There's a guide on how to collect the lichen for like study at home with a microscope or for archival use. And then that got me thinking, because I keep wondering these days, what kind of microscope is good to use for studying lichen? What kind of microscope would people want?
The first thing, it's difficult to study them in the field, even. Like some of them are big and showy, like the Cladonias, but most of them require a hand lens. So it's like a little magnifying glass, essentially. Like I carry around one that has a light on it that is 10 times magnification. And that's to just sort of see differences in the fields. But once you've collected something and you want to study it, any kind of dissecting microscope or stereo microscope, they call it, is the next step. And then if you really want to get into like that's what you need to study most macro lichens, the vast majority. But micro lichens, you would need a compound microscope because you'll be cutting open the fruiting bodies and looking at the spores and that sort of thing. And on occasion, you have to do that with macro lichens as well, but not that often.
I remember I did a online class with Gary Perlmutter
Oh, you did? Great.
through Eagle Hill,
Yeah.
and he was taking samples and cutting them open, and I was like, wow, that's intense. I don't think I have that capability with my field lens, obviously. So
Yeah.
I want to know how to go deeper, but
Yeah.
I wanted to know, you've found two species of lichen, at least two that I know of, that are new to science. And I was
Yeah,
wondering
it's
if you
up
could tell
to
us
about
who they
10 now.
are. I 10 now. Okay,
Yeah.
well, can you tell us one or two of them, of who they are, where you found them, or a little bit about them?
Well, in terms of the Arboretum at Guelph, pretty amazingly, we found a new species back there, a colleague of mine and I, and described it. And we had only, when we described it, we had found it there. It was in the one of the deciduous wetlands on an old stump. And so we looked around at a lot of other similar habitats, and we found it only in one other place. So we were reluctant to describe it based on only two locations, but it was pretty distinctive. And so we went ahead and described it, and it has since showed up regularly. And it was recently discovered in Nova Scotia and in Alberta, but it all started right there in the backyard of Guelph. And it just shows us that we don't, we don't have to go to the tropics or deep ocean vents to find new species. They're still right in our backyard.
Which is pretty cool because I mean, I like an hour before talking to you, I was riding through the Arboretum myself. So it's just like, wow, there's new species just around the corner.
Yeah.
Oh, there was a question I had just on the top of my head. But yeah, you've been working on lichens for so long, you've been publishing consistently, and you obviously have been such a source of knowledge for so many other people. But why are lichens so important to you? Why do you care so much about them?
I think what initially got me into them was that there was so little appreciation for something that was so ubiquitous and so important. They have an immense number of ecological functions, and they're everywhere. They're also spectacular, they're beautiful. And why is it that we give them so little attention? We've been really good at giving our conservation attention and resources to the charismatic megafauna. But the small things out there are just as important to keep ecosystems functioning, if not more, in some cases. And they deserve as much attention as any other organism. I remember someone saying when I first started studying lichens, just like, it's a waste of time. No one cares about a smear on a rock, But why is that life form? Because it's not charismatic, it's not humanoid, it doesn't, it's just not showy enough. Like, those aren't good reasons. This is a life form. All life forms have an intrinsic value, and we should be caring about all of these things equally, and we should be recognizing them as much as any other organism for truly having an understanding of how our ecosystems work and to inform sound conservation decisions. They really there yeah this there's no reason for them not to be recognized. So that's one of the things that's really important for me, is to just have them be included. But it's also, that applies to all the tiny life forms out there, really. Like, so I feel like I'm promoting biodiversity. Like, just I'm trying, one of my goals is to bring lichens to people, but as a broader thing, is just to bring biodiversity more to the forefront. Seeing the forest for the trees. Like, there's so much more that goes on in there, and to our harvesting practices have not generally been sustainable. And when you look at all the other life that's out there, and all the interconnectedness, like they, so it's been a great journey for me. When I, when I first started, it was the community of people that were studying lichens. They were very open, welcoming, and kind community. So that was a deciding factor to study them. But also the adventure of it all. To study these things, it takes me to some of the nicest forests around the world, and so that, like, yeah, there's adventure, there's community, there's conservation, and there's simply just understanding the ecosystems. Like I always thought of myself as a naturalist growing up, and just felt like I had a pretty good understanding of most organisms. But when I look back, I knew nothing about lichens and just how important they are. Like they're immensely important for the arthropods in the forest, for nutrient exchange, for moisture holding capacity. And they, to me, they're kind of like a tool for understanding, or just seeing the forest in a different way, where I can really just sort of see what's happening there much better, clearer than I did before.
Thank
it's a
you
bit of a
for
convoluted answer.
No, that's great. I want to say thank you for bringing that, because I think that's what we need, right? We need a broad, in-depth understanding of our local ecologies, whether it's in the backyard at the Arboretum, or whether it's up north in the Arctic, whether it's downtown Toronto on the subway, like to look at how these small life forms other than human interact with the world around them, how they can be teachers as indicators, or teachers of patience and slow growth, how can we learn from all these species if we don't have folks like yourself and others before you who are doing the work to highlight them and teach others about them? So thank you for putting out this book and doing the work of teaching other people about them, because I wouldn't know anything without books like this. So I appreciate it a lot. My only request is that you come back to the Arboretum and do a workshop someday, because they keep telling me they got no one to do the lichen workshop. So
Well, I'd love to. I did it every year that I was when I was there, and I would
I've
love to
heard.
Return.
Yeah, I've heard. Everybody's like, "Oh, Troy doesn't work here anymore." So, yeah.
My heart's still there. I'll be back.
Cool. Thank you very much, Troy.
Hey, thanks again.
So if I haven't celebrated the book enough already, one more time, this is Lichens, the Macrolichens of Ontario and the Great Lakes region of the United States by Troy McMullen. And it's a thick book. It's really nice. It's about 600 pages, lots of details, lots of notes. Every page or every species intro has the scientific name, a range map, a description of the lichen, the chemistry of how to identify it, including a section at the beginning on working with the chemistry to identify the lichens, where you might find them for habitat, distinctive features, their distribution in Ontario, distribution in North America, and their global distribution, as well as any comments. And each page has a large color photo with identifying details. Sometimes there's more than one. And in the beginning of each section, so there's a large key to all the genera. Like I mentioned, I think it's 113 genera. And then at the beginning of each section on the genera has a key to the species, down to species. So it's pretty thorough, pretty good, very thick. It's a field guide, but it's also hefty. It's a nice field guide. I wonder what weighs more. Oh, I'm picking up Animal Skulls by Mark Albrecht. And that book is also kind of hefty. How many pages is that? About 720. So this weighs similar, but you'll have to check it out. Get to your bookstore, local bookstore, to order it, and you can check it out there. But it's well worth it if you're into lichens and want to learn more, and I always do. So big thanks to Troy McMullen for writing this book and being on the show. And I really do hope he comes back to Guelph to do a workshop at the Arboretum. Sometimes I need someone to hold my hand through things. And lichens, I may have identified one or two on my own now, or more if we count some of the cladonias. But it's nice to have someone there that you can answer all your questions while you're in the field. So this book does its best at that. So I appreciate having it and getting to review it. If you want to learn more about the show, you can go to toknowtheland.com. On Instagram, it's at toknowtheland. You can email me, toknowtheland@gmail.com. If you want to support the show, you can always go to toknowtheland.com/donate. And you can donate if you want to, if that works for you. That's great. Like the show, share it with your friends. I hope to do more. Maybe I'll tell a story sometime and record it as a show of my recent eval, tracking eval in southwestern New York, because it was quite a good time, quite a lovely time there. And yeah, worth talking about. That's it. Take care.